Hello and welcome back to the Challenger Cities podcast. I think we're now up to episode 20. So this is the point when a podcast turns into a proper podcast, right? Anyway, amazing guest today. I'm with Nick Tyler, who might be one of the most fascinating minds in urban innovation today, anyway, where we talk about what if the way we design our cities is making us more stressed, less connected, and less happy. So Nick's a great person for this because he's got a really eclectic career background in that he was a musician, an oboist, turned engineer, turned groundbreaking transport researcher. He now leads PEARL, which is the Person Environment Activity Research Laboratory at University College London. He came recommended from two separate people, Charlie Rowett and Thomas Abelman. Both said, this guy is amazing. And he is. You'll hear that in a minute. But anyway, at PEARL, Nick and his team, they recreate urban environments like bus stops, train platforms, entire streets. Catnips, someone like me, to uncover how design impacts the way we feel, behave, and connect. So that even includes the design and the philosophy of floating bus stops, which is something that we will talk about in great length in this episode. So if that is your thing, stay tuned. Anyway, we explore how empathy should be at the heart of urban planning, how designing for neurodiversity makes spaces better for everyone, and at the end, how a simple hello to a bus driver might be the most revolutionary act that you can commit in your city. Anyway, Nick challenges a lot of big assumptions, things like, why do we need to move so much? What if cities were designed not just for efficiency, but actually for humans to be happy and flourish? Anyway, if you've ever done anything or ever wondered what it takes to make a city that feels alive, where people can thrive, this is the episode for you. So, without further ado, here is a conversation with the wonderful Nick Tyler.
So, Nick, I would love to start here because you came to me with this most amazing introduction from somebody that I'd interviewed previously. He's kind of like Doc Brown, but British, which I was like, I have to meet this man now, and you were very gracious and took the time to have a chat with me. But I'd love to get into this with a little bit about you, Nick, your background, and then we'll go into PEARL and why it's a fantastic thing that I now have a huge crush on.
Yep. Okay. So me is a bit complicated. I guess, actually, the more I do stuff, the more I realize how important the early things were. So actually, I spent my what academics call my background, which by which they mean what did you sort of waste your time doing when you were 18. My background is actually music, and I studied at the Royal College of Music, and I played as a professional oboist for about 10 years, and then one way or another sort of ended up not doing that anymore and came into the sort of transport world kind of by sort of accident, really. Actually, the reality is I thought it'd be a good idea to do a master's, so I looked around for a master's to do, but the only master's I could get to do was in transport, because everybody else, either on the music side, they said, all this transport stuff you've been doing, this has nothing to do with music, you must be impossible. On the sort of industry and engineering or whatever side, they all said, what's this music stuff? We can't possibly have that. But eventually a particular university decided that it was safe enough for me to go in there. So I did a master's in transportation planning and management. And from there, I ended up, I went from there into a job at UCL. Initially, it was to research how Brazilian engineers designed high-capacity bus systems. And that's what I did. This is a long time ago. And then I realized all the conventional ways of doing that were pretty rubbish. So I sort of invented ways of trying to model how this guy's mind worked. And that was actually really, really interesting, because it became obvious to me that whereas all of the conventional engineering is about how do I make my mind up, what the actual engineer was doing was kind of undoing that. He was unmaking his mind. He was opening because the formal ways didn't work. So he had to do something. And I realized that the excitement was about how you change your mind. And that rang a real bell with me, because professional musician, you are always creating and you are in the moment. So musicians, what do musicians do? Musicians, this is going to be sound very effete, but musicians kind of take a note out of the future play it in the present, but actually it's in the past. So, because by the time you've played it, it's past. You can't change it. So musicians actually handle time in that kind of way. We work in the future, basically, and are revealed in the present in an indelible past. So you're kind of stuck with what you've got. You play a wrong note, it's a wrong note. You know, you can't undo it. You can't blame the contract. You know, you can't say clause 17.3 wasn't really that. It was something else. So, and I realized the kind of similarity, and I realized that actually this is actually quite interesting to think about how one engineered, but from a musical perspective. But I never dared let engineers know that that's what I was doing. So, and I kept that secret for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But that was actually, it was very, very instructive because it ran so counter to the way that typically engineering education was working, how engineering research was being done. It was all about making your mind up. And actually, it's kind of really about undoing it. And I think that was where it is. So then I ended up doing that. And somebody came and looked at my work, looked over my shoulder at my work one day at the university. He said, "This is rubbish." And my supervisor was so annoyed. He said, "You must do this as a PhD." So I kind of converted that work into a PhD, and that's how I got my PhD. So my PhD is kind of on artificial intelligence, but a rather different way of thinking about artificial intelligence than you do now, actually. And then I ended up on the staff at the university, and they decided that I should run the civil engineering department. So I became a sort of pseudo civil engineer, and ran as the head of department for, I don't know what, 10 and a half years. And then I stepped aside from that because you do terms, I stepped aside from that and carried on. That's kind of where I am now. But the in the middle of all of this is there is this question of time. And, you know, what is future, past, present? What's Newton got to do with anything? And what about other ways of thinking about time? And, you know, do musicians actually think about time in that Newtonian sort of way? And answer, not really. And so can I start to think about the world we're in? So move on from your high-capacity bus systems and changing your mind into why we've got high-capacity bus systems and why are we doing those sorts of things? And how do people interact with these things? And that got me interested in how people think and how people respond to stimuli and why is it that different people respond differently and so on. So that started to lead me into the world of all sorts of things, you know, philosophy at one end, fine arts at the other. Psychology, then into neuroscience. What was making the psychology work wasn't really psychology. It was actually underneath that. So what's underneath that? Well, you start to look at neurons. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at neurons, you realize you have 86 billion neurons in your head. Well, most of them in your head. But actually, that's not the way to look at the brain. What you actually have is essentially a network, a massive network. And even that is not the way to look at the brain. Your brain is constantly regenerating itself in the sense of reforming its structure so that it's like a network that is constantly adapting to the circumstances that it's in. And people used to think that that was a very long-term thing. Plasticity in the brain's been knocking around as a concept for a few decades. And it was kind of thought, if you do this enough, your brain will change to make it easier. That's absolutely fine. That's great. We know that. What has been surprising more recently in the last few years is the thought that the brain is actually doing that actually by the millisecond. And that starts to explain some of these issues around why people do one thing and some people do another and all of that sort of stuff. So if I want to explore how does that relate to how we live in a modern society, I need to kind of build a world in which you can do that. And so let's build a world. Now, that's quite complicated. You know, it took 4.5 billion years to kind of make the planet into the mess we've made it into. So how are we going to do that? And so I thought, well, you can do a bit of the world. So I made a space in which I can build worlds where I can control things. So I can control the light, I can control what it looks like. I can control the sound, the noise, the acoustic effects of it. I can control the smell, I can control the feel. I can even control the speed that you're moving around in. It's all of those sorts of things. And then I can then see how do these people's individual networks of 86 billion neurons with all of their interconnections, how do they respond and how do they do that? And so in order to do that, you have to build a big space because those neurons are responding to a world. As soon as I put a wall around me, I'm responding to the wall. And the brain's not stupid. It's actually pretty smart. So it says that there's a wall. This is not the world. You're fooling me. So I have to have the wall far enough away that you are convinced that there's not a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can create the illusions. And then the brain will respond to illusions. So the way to do that kind of exploration, how do I make a society, how do I understand how to make a society that is representative of how people communicate with each other, how they communicate with the environment and how the environment communicates with them, is to create the illusion. And so we create illusions of things and then we study how people respond to that. And that's kind of what Pearl is, and that's how we got there, if that makes any sense at all.
It makes sense. I think the bit that is sort of mind-boggling is the combination of different fields of thinking that you've navigated through over those years to get to now, where it's often quite hard for a marketer to deal with a financial person in a company. And yet you've gone through musician, engineer, psychologist, academic. You've gone through all those different fields and made something that I don't think it really matters which world you're from. You can look at Pearl and be like, that's amazing, because it's something I don't necessarily understand, or it's things that are going to be probably counterintuitive. There's a magic to that. And I think that's what's fascinating me, that somebody went from playing the oboe to making that, without trying to fancy too much. But like that, I think that sort of like grabbed my brain recently, that especially in this context of, I've talked to a lot of engineers and they're amazing, smart people, and they know how to do things far better than I do. But I always think there's a really interesting blind spot to a lot of them. So the fact that like we're now bringing into this world like fascinates me. So like, maybe the next best place to go is talk about a little bit of some of the projects that go through Pearl and what excites you.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pearl is actually still quite a baby. I mean, we built it during the COVID pandemic, actually. And so it's been going for 2-3 years, really, since we've been doing things. And one of the issues that we've had is to explain to people what it does. And this is kind of where I sort of realized that not everybody quite thinks the way I do. It's taken me a little while to understand that. But and that's part of being an oboe. They tune the orchestra to the oboe for a very good reason, because the oboe player is insistent. but I think it's been interesting, and it's been quite a journey to get people to begin to understand it. But now we are beginning to get that response, that people realize that what we can do for them is something you can't do somewhere else. So for example, somebody, we have a problem in the UK. I don't know whether you do in Canada, but we have a problem in the UK with kind of bus stop, which is integrated with a cycle lane.
Yeah.
And these
the floating
are
ones.
Yeah. These are euphemistically called floating island bus stops. And I always have this sort of impression of the Maldives with this concept of the floating. I would imagine this sort of ocean with a bus stop floating around on it. And sometimes it might feel like that. But there are issues with these, and they're installed because there is a quite strong drive to increase the amount of what we call active travel. So essentially, in effect, human-powered movement. And cycling, of course, is one of the elements of that. And that means that you have to kind of do something about the mix of cycling and traffic, because cars tend to kill cyclists. And so it's not a good mix. So we need to do something with cyclists. And that has led into building cycle lanes, or what we would call cycle lanes. And you can kind of do that in small, polite ways. But then when you start to get enough of them, they start with other things, and one of the things they begin to interfere with is the interaction between buses and passengers, where the passenger wants to get on the bus, so the passenger is actually crossing from a pedestrian space into a road space, and the bus is usually on the road. And if you if you've got a cycle going around here somewhere and you don't want the cycle to integrate with the traffic at that point, which is what we're trying to avoid, so you don't want it to do that, what do you do with the cycle lane? And the answer is you put it around somehow or other around the bus stop, and there are various ways of doing that, but it causes a problem between cyclists and pedestrians, in particular with pedestrians more sensitive. So people with sight loss, neurodiverse people, people who move more slowly or more stiffly, so they're not quite so agile at moving around, things like that. And these are groups of people who figure in the pedestrian community and the bus passenger community. So they tend to be at bus stops and the cycle, and there is a sort of kind of issue. And if you talk to those people about these bus stops, they will complain bitterly about them. So we were asked to have a look at this at Pearl, because I think the reason was they knew we were big enough. We could build a bus stop with a bus and cycle lane, and we could actually do something with it at scale rather than just go and watch it on a street where there's lots of other things going on. So how do you unpick what's actually happening at the bus stop? So we had a kind of, if you can imagine, a kind of pure bus stop. So it wasn't messed up by other stuff happening. It was a bus stop at scale, according to the regulations, built with a bus that you got on and off, with a cycle lane and so on. So we looked at the interaction between the cycles and the bus passengers. And the thing that was interesting, I think, about this, that came out of this, was not so much, I think what they expected, maybe it was to say these things are too dangerous, you shouldn't have them, or something like that. I think they thought,
give me an excuse to get rid of this, or give me a justification for keeping it.
Where they were coming from. But, or it might be about dimensions. If you make the cycle lane like this, if you'd made that color, if you put this thing there or something like that, it would be better, or something like that. But what actually came out of this was that the very existence of the bus stop in that form created a sense of fear and heightened stress in those passengers. It didn't need a cycle to do that. It was simply the fact that they're in that space. So why does that happen? Well, that happens because the way that you understand the world is that you build a perception, and you build that perception in your and or brain. Let's not worry too much about that for now. But you build that. Your brain actually sees, hears, smells nothing. It just gets electrical stimuli. So you receive all this sensory information. And what's going on is that your brain starts with your lived experience. Everything that you've experienced since actually before you were born. Some people would argue even before conception. Some people would argue 4 billion years ago. Don't need to go there. But essentially, you have these lived experiences onto which you apply your incoming data from the senses. And what you're trying to do is to create a kind of perception of the world, a kind of prediction of the world that says, what's the world going to be like in the next few milliseconds? And that's what the brain does. It predicts that so that it can help you survive. So when the person experiences a bus stop, even this pure bus stop inside a laboratory, this is not on the street, it's inside a built laboratory, but it's a real bus stop. Everything else about it is real. Your lived experience says, this is a dangerous place. Your senses are receiving all of the same information that you would have. It looks like a bus stop. It sounds like a bus stop. It sounds like a traffic system. It sounds like all these sorts of things. And therefore, my perception of this is a dangerous place. My brain is trying to make me survive. It is firing up the hormones that are going into fear, flee kind of mode. And therefore, this is what I'm doing. And that's kind of what we measure. And I think this has caused quite a lot of shock, because it's changed the nature of the debate. It's not about cycle lanes and bus stops. It's about how do you have a society that creates fear in a particular section of that society.
It's interesting, the analogy I would take that to Toronto as an example, but in Toronto they have trams, but they call them streetcars because they're dated, but they run in the road. But when you get on or off the streetcar, you're at instead of stepping into a bike lane, you're stepping into traffic.
Yeah.
And it's kind of I guess it's a similar problem, albeit like you're not on the island. But when you go through that, what happens next? We establish that our brain is making us fearful because of this thing that we've designed. What do you do about it?
Well, your brain is, as I say, trying to make you survive. So what it's trying to do, it's got all these senses, it's trying to make sense of the world. So it's saying, first thing it's saying, I'm in this very dangerous situation, I need to get out of it. So it will be doing things like producing adrenaline and cortisol and things like that, which are basically pumping energy into your bloodstream so that you've got the energy to run away. Remember that this is actually a system really devised to protect you from, I don't know, some lion that thinks you're breakfast. So that's where our evolution has got us to. So that's what it's got. That's what it does. So that's how it's responding to a threat. One of the problems here is that you can't actually escape from it, because either you may not be physically capable of doing it, of course, but also the situation is one that you can't necessarily do that. All of this is going in your preconscious. You're completely unaware of any of this. And so the setup is that the brain is then trying to ameliorate that in the way that it knows. And the only real way it knows is, as I say, the release of hormones. It might then say, I think you need to know about this consciously. So I will tell your conscious awareness side, if you like, that this is going on. You might need to make a decision. You might need to put in some conscious work. So that gives you a conscious set of work that your brain has to do. So it increases the cognitive load. So you're now going to have to start thinking about what you're going to do. All of that takes time. And so you are really in a very weak position getting off your streetcar into a stream of traffic. You're relying, in effect, on the stream of traffic not to hit you, because you won't be able, there's not a lot you can do about being, if it decides it's going to hit you, it will hit you. And so you have to, that's kind of where you're at. So the brain's real instinct is not to do it, if it could possibly avoid it. And that's why we really need to think about sort of infrastructure that we're talking about that says, actually, we shouldn't really be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. That is a good parallel. And maybe car drivers slow down and things like that. Cyclists, interesting. I mean, the
cycling does something to your brain, which I can share an anecdote about later, but like cyclists behave so weirdly. And I say this as someone who, like, I really like cycling, but I don't want to be like a sort of cycling militant. But you there's something strange happens to you when you get on a bike.
Yes. That is actually in the brain. So what's going on there is a mechanism which says I need to focus on something. So when you're cycling, you actually have to think quite all. You're dealing with a world which is quite far ahead. And in order to do that, you will focus down. So you will narrow off your vision, visual field. You'll be looking, I don't know how far ahead, 50, 100 meters, whatever it is, far ahead. And you will be focused on that. And you will be aiming to meet that. So you're working towards being in that place. And you're actually very poor at dealing with stuff that is closer. There is a sort of kind of issue, and it's kind of made worse. This is a bit of a guess on my part. I think it might be being made worse because the cycle works because as long as it's moving, and that's how it stays upright, is because it's moving. And therefore, you have a kind of sense when you're cycling that you need to keep the bike moving. And you combine that with this long-term, narrowed-down sort of kind of vision, concentrated vision on the world, and actually something like a pedestrian doing something rather more eccentric, let's call it, at a bus stop, is way out of your consciousness. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's the cyclist's fault. So I'm not saying that there is something wrong that the cyclists are doing. I think it's actually a natural effect of cycling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually where we need to start to think about that. So if we're going to do something to help this situation, I think we need to look at, well, what is it that would enable us to be able to get the cyclist to respond as a human being to somebody else? So how can we actually do that in a way that the cyclist feels comfortable doing that, doesn't feel frustrated? Because if they feel frustrated, that's another brain response. We don't want it to do that. So it needs to feel comfortable with that. And so how do we actually design the environment in order to be able to do that? And I think that is a job of work. And that's certainly something we could do in Pearl. I mean, because we can set up those kind of environments. And I think the interesting thing is, and this kind of goes back to why Pearl is so important, is that what we're looking at here is, in the end, what you've got is a person on a bicycle, not just a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, of course, would happen with a driver in a car as opposed to just a car. And it's how those, and a pedestrian is a person. You know, when we start to think like that, I think it changes the focus of the design onto the interaction between the people, the human beings, the societal sociality thing, and how we get those to work together, and how do we design our mobility system to be able to enable those to work together. And then I think the bicycle and the pedestrian and the car actually will fit. But there's a lot of, it's a completely different way of looking at the problem, because it means you have to sort of get inside the head.
Mm-hmm.
First, and our methods for getting inside the head are not great, I think.
I think of that bus stop, and I go back to not that long ago, I was riding an electric bike share in London past one of those bus stops. And I think there's sort of different ways that cyclists will handle this. But like, I was sort of looking at ahead, and my reaction was just slow right down, like just don't push it. And then a lady sort of stepped out into, because she wanted to get on the bus and she was sort of rushing for the bus. And any sort of, I stopped, she like shouted something abusive at me, she stepped across the thing and got on the bus. But like, it's that sort of dynamic of, yes,
she's thinking I'm the
bad guy, yeah. I'm thinking I'm being the nice guy, and you end up with a very sort of difficult situation.
Exactly. So, but I think part of what I'm saying is this is absolutely natural and biologically what happens. So she, in trying to get on the bus, has the same kind of focus. So she will narrow the focus down. This is how the brain enables you to do things. Focus down, do this stuff, and yeah, I need to get to that door. I need to get there by this route and so on. And now the speed that she is doing that is going to be at something in the order of a meter a second or something like that. So she has and she's trying to do that. Maybe she needs to rush a bit to get on the bus or whatever it is, but that's where her focus is. She catches you out of the side of her eye or wherever, and almost irrespective of what you're doing, you're just an object, because she's not going to see you in the first instance. The preconscious brain, remember, it's the preconscious brain that makes all this happen. So the preconscious brain is going to pick you up in the peripheral vision. The peripheral vision wouldn't see you, I think, as a person. They would see you as just an object that's moving. And so she will be, so the system will say, what is that thing that is moving? It's a threat. And that's when she will first begin to identify that you are a cyclist and so on, which all of this is taking, you know, milliseconds. And that is breaking her. That then says, I've got a threat. I have to deal with this threat. Whoosh is a load of cortisol and adrenaline and stuff, puts her into the fight flight mode.
Okay.
And then her natural response is whatever it is. It may be to shout abuse. It may be to run. It may be to freeze in fear. It may be whatever it is. But that is all driven by that. And that's kind of the problem. You've got your side. Now, you're describing a cyclist. You've obviously clocked that there is a bit of a problem here. You need to slow down and et cetera, et cetera. And you are doing that. So you lessen the risk or lessen the hazard even by doing that, of course, which is great. But you've still got this joining together of almost incompatible brain responses, and those two individuals are not going to work well together. And that's the natural thing to happen. I think that's the piece to understand. So how do we actually deal with that? Well, one would be you don't have that interaction, which is, if you like this, you know, you said, well, let's not have those bus stops. But actually, in the end of the day, we kind of need them. You know, maybe there is a deeper problem, which is nothing to do with cyclists and pedestrians and bus passengers and bus stops. It's actually to do with, why are we bringing cyclists to interact with pedestrians? Why aren't they in a space on their own? Well, the answer to that is because they interfere with traffic, and traffic tends to kill them. And if you know, the encounter between a car and a cyclist is rarely good. And so isn't the question then about why we've got cars? And if you've got the question about why we've got cars, well, we've got cars because we think we need to move. And we, as a society, we tolerate cars killing lots and lots of people and injuring lots and lots of people. So we think they're very important. So why? And that's because the reason for, or the ability to survive, requires various things to be satisfied. And those things are not where we are. So we need to go somewhere to get them. And we haven't really thought about where those things are and also when they are. So they tend to be too far away.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, the active travel piece is fine. If I can walk walkable distance, I can buy my cup of coffee or whatever. That is a very popular thing to have. If we ask people, what would you like within walking distance? It tends to be bakeries and coffee shops. In Western culture, it tends to be bakeries and coffee shops. And so if you had one of those within walking distance, you wouldn't need a car to go and get it. And once you're in your coffee shop and you don't have your car, then whatever you do next will be also in that kind of mode. So there's kind of a lot of sense of having things like that. It doesn't necessarily have to be a coffee shop or a bakery, but whatever that thing is for that community, that is actually quite a good thing to have, because you're going to reduce the amount of movement necessary in order to survive. And that, so perhaps we need to think about those needs and wants of society, or needs, wants, and likes, if you like, of society, of a community, and how do we actually enable those to happen so that, in a way, we don't need so much movement. And then you start to do all sorts of them, and you start to think that way around. Well, then we find we have fewer cars. Then you don't have such a problem with the cyclists and the cars. Then you don't have your problem with the passengers in the bus and the cycles. So actually fixing the bus stop is kind of like putting a Band-Aid.
Yeah, it's not the core problem to solve effectively.
I think we have to think much more deeply about why, for our survival, are we moving? And that's not to say we shouldn't move. We are not a sedentary species. Or one of the big health problems of the 21st century is people are becoming sedentary, and we are not a sedentary species. So it's not about staying still. It's about having a much more intelligent discussion about what are the likes, wants, and needs. And we do that, actually. So if you take something like a snack or a soft drink or something like that, what does the manufacturer do with this thing? They don't just give you an apple. They don't make money at giving you an apple. What they do is they give you an apple in a form where you get more apple, more sugar, more whatever. Even if it's just simply a natural apple, just let's not talk about an artificial one, but a natural apple, if you scrunch it all up and you make it all into a thing, so I get a teaspoon and I get a whole apple or whatever in a spoon, and I eat this, and in order for me to be able to do that, I fill it with sugar and do all that sort of kind of stuff. What I'm actually doing is I'm satisfying, I like an apple. But actually, when I've eaten that spoon, that apple pureed into a spoon, what's my reaction is I want another one. And so that's the difference between like and want. And so what the manufacturer does is they convert like into want. And eventually you say, I cannot exist if I don't have an apple. So my like has turned into want, has turned into need. And maybe we need to look at mobility in that succession. I think I need to drive a car to that place in order to be able to do this thing. But actually, I don't. The reality is I need to satisfy my likes and my wants. And there's nothing wrong with satisfying your likes and wants as long as they're not going to kill anybody. But I need to satisfy those because that's how I survive. That's what survival is. But actually, I need to keep them kind of in control. And in a way, your actual Apple, your real Apple, is a way of doing that, because your real Apple satisfies your taste, your sugar need, the volume. So you know when you've had an Apple, you've had enough. So your want and your like and your want have been satisfied. So you don't think you need another Apple. And that's kind of one of the controls on things like diet. So the more, so if you translate that into a mobility world, it's kind of a bit like that. We're kind of hooked on having to go somewhere. And we've almost forgotten why. We find a reason for why, because I really need to move somewhere. And the reason for it might be whatever it is. And it gets translated back into what, and back into like, that's why I like sitting in the car. I like having air conditioning. I like having the music that I want in the car, and I don't, and other people, not, all of those kinds of things. So it's as almost as if we're doing it all backwards. And so I'm wondering whether we need to understand that process, that, you know, the brain side of that process more, so that we can actually start to unpick it in the mobility world, so that we can now start to say, actually, what does society need? So if you look at the Maslow hierarchy.
Yep.
So Maslow, very famous and very interesting. So you have the basic needs and all the rest of it up to the self-actualization is at the top of the hierarchy. Right? Interestingly, Maslow never produced a hierarchy.
Right, did not know that.
That was all produced somewhere else. What Maslow actually did, he was very interested in how people made decisions. So he thought it'd be very interesting to go and look at how people make decisions. So he went and lived with the Blackfoot tribe for about 6 months in the late 1930s.
Uh-huh.
And he
what was left of them then?
Sorry?
What was left?
Well, they were even fewer now. But so he went and lived with them and talked with them about how they decided things. And that's where this kind of idea of the blend of spirituality and common purpose and of course, yes, survival stuff, you know, eat, food, water, shelter, how all these things came together in these decisions for the community. And then he wrote this all up and he produced a paper and he wanted to publish this paper and nobody would publish it. And the reason they wouldn't publish it was because it came from the Blackfoot tribe. So it got heavily doctored. And eventually the paper that the famous Maslow paper published in 1943, so about 5 years after he'd done the work, talks about these things and how they come together to form this kind of decision-making. But he never mentioned hierarchy. He never said you had to do one before the other. And his model, his own diagram of this is actually a circle. And what he is saying is that those elements that are presented in the hierarchy, but those elements are actually much more in temporal functional terms, are much more at the same time. And you might balance, you're looking at a balance. You're looking at, well, actually for this, I'm going to need to, it's a bit more about spirituality. I need to, whatever that is. Or for this other thing, it's a bit more important about shelter. Mm-hmm. And for this other thing, and so on, you would have a little move around there. But what you're actually looking at is balance, equilibrium amongst these things. And I think it's an interesting one, because if you take that view, come back to our bus stop, and you have, how would we apply that way of thinking to that kind of situation? And suddenly, maybe the ordering of how we are prioritizing our street changes. And maybe we need to sort of start to rethink like that. So then I say to myself, yeah, that's all very fine. I can sit in a university and say, well, that. But so how am I going to convince the world about that? Well, it's an interesting one. I think it's doable. I think you could actually have, if you stopped thinking about your city as a city, but thought of it as a kind of conjunction of communities.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually small and make the things smaller. get into the kinds of group size that people can actually make decisions, that's actually quite small. And if you get your group size being able to make a decision as a group, you begin to understand what you can do. And then essentially, you then figure out how you join those groups together. And eventually, you end up with a city of 10 million people. But actually, in a city of 10 million people, very few of those people actually encounter each other. It's actually a much, much smaller frame. And of course, people like Robin Dunbar looked at the biology, if you like, behind group size and things like that. And they kind of settle on numbers around those sorts of groupings that could make that decision. So maybe we should be actually having that conversation about things like the bus stop or things like low traffic neighborhoods, as we would call them here, pedestrian zones and things like that. Have that conversation within the community and then be able to have that conversation across communities and so on. But you're actually now having them as conversations, not as conflicts. And so you can start to begin to build that sense of a community that says, okay, in my community, 150 people, whatever, in my community, I can, you know, we'll have a coffee shop. I think that sounds like a really cool idea. We'll have a coffee shop. Shoe shop? Less bothered about a shoe shop. Be nice to have a shoe shop fairly near. I don't want to have to walk 200 miles to go and find.
That other community has a shoe shop. We can go to that.
Exactly. So you are actually starting to think about the way that the structuring of those likes and wants and needs are now spread around those communities. And then you start to build your mobility system to join up those likes and wants and needs. And whether you have cars or buses or bus stops or cycling or whatever it is comes later. And it then makes sense because people are understanding that what we're actually doing isn't trying to facilitate movement. What we're trying to do is to encourage a thriving life.
Mm-hmm.
And Homo sapiens as a social species, thriving life means sociality. We have part of the brain which is about social connectedness. That's what fires it up. And we have that. And what we're doing if we when we go into isolation from each other, we are kind of killing off that bit of the brain. So the plasticity of the brain kind of switches it off. So we stop being socially connected. And then we become isolationists. And then we become awkward. And then we become difficult and all the rest of it. So it actually does come down to, I think we have to sort of start to think about how does the species survive? Species survives through social connectedness, therefore sociality, therefore community, therefore mobility, therefore, and somewhere way down the end is movement, and even further down the end is transport.
There's something really interesting as you talk through that experience starting from the bus stop. I don't think anyone's had a conversation about a bus stop on a podcast for quite this time.
Not as a philosophical concept. You've never seen it.
I'm enjoying it, though. It's I remember being in InnoTrans a few years ago in Berlin where they have like a giant railway yard conference center. There's like 27 something conference halls, a railway yard. Everybody from the global train industry descends on it. And there are a handful of really clever organizations doing like visualizations of people movement in redesigned train stations. And I remember looking at them on a screen going, oh my God, that is amazing. That's so clever. But I'd also just read Rory Sutherland and Pete Dyson's book, Transport for Humans. And I spent most of my career looking at what are the weird things that people do that are kind of hard to explain. And it's interesting you had this very clever technical engineering mindset of this is how people move through the station. And I spoke to a guy who was looking at the screen next to me, and he was from one of the Japanese railway companies. And he said, if you did that in Japan, what no one takes into account is somebody stopping, lost for directions, probably a tourist, because then that model would explode. And I think he was being a little bit hyperbolic about it, but it's that we model these things often in the everyone's going to behave in a uniform and rational way without taking into the context of what if that tunnel smells bad? What if that it's a rainy, horrible day at the bus stop that day? What if there's a middle-aged man in Lycra, like careering down the bike lane, whatever it might be, but like we lose the psychology of it. It might not make sense when we're writing it down on paper or typing it into a model, but I think if you bridge those worlds, you're onto making the world and cities and communities way better places, but it's really, really hard to bridge it. So
yep.
I'm sort of fascinated in how you're doing that.
That's absolutely right. I mean, those models are basically built on mechanical models. So you start with ball bearings, you know. You can give the ball bearings all sorts of characteristics. You can make them soft and squidgy or whatever. But essentially, once you've declared a ball bearing with certain characteristics in your model, it stays like that. But people change all the time. And so even if you could represent a person perfectly in a ball bearing kind of model as a mechanical thing, object, be physically right size, even you can even put psychological size. I might be 70 centimeters wide, but I think I am 1 meter wide. Or I feel as if I'm 1 meter wide, or I don't want other people within 1 meter of me, or all of those kinds. You can put all that into those models. But that will change. And that's the piece and it's those changes. When you start to multiply the numbers of people, instead of thinking, if I put more people in my model, I will create a kind of average idea. And then I know that I need to design for that average plus a bit. That's kind of how it looks. But actually, the problem is that it's actually an average of, there isn't such a thing as an average in this sense. It's kind of an abuse of the term, really, because what you've actually got is lots of different things.
You've got lots of weirdos, basically.
Exactly. Everyone is slightly different. And it's the differences that are actually making things happen. So if you just squash them all into an average, it really doesn't work. And you can get away with it up to a point. But when you start to put it under pressure, you then work into the world where actually those micro differences really do matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where your Japanese guy is alluding to, really, I think, is yes, it's probably a tourist, because the tourist doesn't understand the signage, doesn't understand the culture of how you move through a ticket gate or whatever it is. And actually what we really need to be doing is understanding much more about how do I accommodate that difference. For that reason, we can do all that in Perl. Perl is kind of built to do that. But interestingly, it does bring to mind something else, because in the end, so I study now. We're going to be doing some. It's actually right now would be a very small project later this year with some musicians. So we're working with musicians. So why are we working with musicians? Well, we're working with musicians because musicians use their hearing. And a musician's hearing is just the same as everybody else's hearing. And our hearing, the human hearing, has evolved. Why do we have ears? Well, we have ears. We asked this question about e-scooter alarm sound. Why have we got ears? And when you look at it, the reason we have ears is because in the savannah, when we emerged into the savannah, the people who survived were the people who could hear the snap of a twig and look at where that sound was and discover that it was a lion very hungry coming to eat, or it was a monkey that they could eat. So the people who survived got the right call. Our hearing, that's kind of the basis of our hearing. So humans are actually really good at small sounds, at directionality. We have a particular bit of the brain, which is where the auditory signals and the visual signals come together. So that's how, when you hear a sound sort of kind of behind you and you turn around to look where it is while you are looking at where the sound was, we're very, very good at doing that. And that's a survival thing, because you couldn't get all of the information about that lion through your ears. So you need your eyes, and you only have a very small part of your vision system that's high enough resolution to see that it's a lion. So by sticking those two things together, that's how that works. People who were very good at looking up at the sky, where there wasn't anything at all, they died because the lion came in late. Mm-hmm. So their genes didn't get passed on. So that's our hearing system. Now, when I study, so musicians are magicians of time. They're magicians of many, many things. But one of the things they're magicians at is hearing. And they use their hearing. So musicians play by ear. The processing of the audio, the auditory signals and the auditory system is way faster than the vision system. And so you are processing everything by ear. So when you see an orchestra playing, the musicians are playing together by ear, not by eye. Conductors are kind of there for the audience to look at. The musicians are working together, and they are looking at micro gestures, the way somebody's breathing, the slight figure of a wrist in a fiddle player or something like that. And that's how they are able to play together. If you change the acoustics, they have to make an adjustment. And musicians actually are really good at doing that. You can take a musician out of one example, one place, put them in another, and they will very quickly work out the differences they have to make to their musical technique in order to cope with that. So we are going to run an experiment where we do that. We put them in a performance space and we change the acoustics, and then we study how they are making those adjustments, both neurologically but also physically. So why do that with musicians? Well, we do it with musicians because they're very, very good at it. But you, well, I don't know whether you're a musician, but people who are not musicians also have that capability. It's just they don't have to hone it to the same degree. Mm-hmm. When I change the acoustics in Pearl so that it sounds like Westminster Abbey, people start talking like a bishop. So you don't need to be a musician to respond to the change in acoustics. It's just that the musicians respond very precisely. So we can look at that. And if we understand that, then we can start to understand how that affects a person who is not a musician. And you take, so one of the things we're doing now is we're looking at that approach. So if I take neurodiverse people, so there's a lot of interest around neurodiverse people, and they're seen as being very complex and difficult, basically neglected in the consideration of a transport system, for example. Now we could just get a box of neuro, put them all in a box and say, oh yes, well they do something and they do this or that or the other or whatever it is. And of course, when you start to look at neurodiverse people in any detail, you realize that every single neurodiverse person is different from every other neurodiverse person and different from everybody else. But then when you look at everybody else, you see that they are all different from each other as well. And so actually I'm very interested in working with neurodiverse people to understand those differences, because for them it's a critical difference. For somebody else it's a tolerable, something might be a bit annoying, but for a neurodiverse person, that noise or that massive excess of data coming in visually or whatever it is isn't just annoying, it goes beyond a threshold. So by understanding that, the same principle applies. We can start to understand how that works for other people. And that enables us to start thinking, how do I design my railway station so that it accommodates the neurodiverse person? Because if I do that, I know it's going to accommodate everybody else. Because actually, there isn't a separation between neurodiverse people and what they call neurotypical people. We're actually all in there.
As my auntie would have said, we're all on the spectrum.
Yeah. Yes, it is a spectrum in that sense. And I think and by understanding in a much more sort of empathic kind of way, understanding how does somebody else see these things, we can actually start to create better ways of solving some of these problems. And that may mean we alter the way of a station acoustic, or we think much more strongly about it, not just in terms of decibels and hertz and reverberation times and all these nice physical things that we can measure, but actually about the feelings and the responses, the reactions that you're getting inside the human that enables them to live and thrive in that world. Because all of those things are how the brain is getting us to respond to threats or opportunities, of course, so that we can survive.
How do you then bridge the gap into the engineering realm, where often things are seen as linear, logical, there's a standard way of doing things? Because I see like more of this in the world where people get very upset with how much it costs to build things, how much it costs to renovate things, but then they also get upset when they don't work properly. And actually, if you bring the psychology side into it with the engineering side, you probably end up delivering them better, faster, cheaper. But how do you bridge that gap?
Okay, so engineers, so Yes, when I changed all our engineering, civil engineering programs when I was head of departments, it was a great thing to do. It was very, very bold of the university to put a musician in charge of civil engineering. One of the things that really struck me was engineers live by codes. And obviously, this is going to be very simplistic, but essentially, there are a whole bunch of codes. You have a code for what steel should be. You have a code for whatever it is. And engineers, a lot of civil engineering education has been about learning those codes. And what an engineer will typically do, I'm going to be a bit unfair on engineers here, so I apologize in advance.
They can handle it.
But if you like, the lazy engineer, or it's certainly within the capability of an engineer to do this, well, what they will do, their safe margin is, I do what the code says, because then I'm not going to get sued. So somebody says to me, you built that bridge, it fell down. And I say that the steel was code whatever. And then I'm safe. I'm not going to be sued. If I thought, actually, this bridge is a bit dodgy, a lot of wind in there, I might need to do something more than the code. I might need to do something else. That's me taking a risk. And if the bridge falls down, I will get sued. And they will say, why didn't you follow the code?
It's better to fail unconventionally, so, or conventionally sometimes, than it is to succeed unconventionally.
Exactly, yeah. So you end up, it's a very defensive way of looking at these things. So when you are going to interface with an engineer in that mode, you kind of have to deal with the codes, because that's what is backing up what they're doing. And we've done some very interesting things recently about that, because, for example, we had safety regulator realized that all the stations are subject to the same code for lighting. And but there's always complaints about the lighting in the station. What do you want the light? So I said to them, they said, we could use your laboratory because it has a very flexible lighting system here. We could work out what our code for lighting should be. I said, well, what do you want the lighting to do? So they went away because they couldn't answer that. So they went away, they came, well, that's complicated. Because what do we want lighting to do? Well, when the driver looks along the train to see if there's somebody, is it safe to close the doors and drive the train? They need to be able to see passengers near the train. So, and they've got to see it. They've got a long train, so they've got to see it, you know, maybe 150, 200 meters away. And that passenger might be sitting there in a black coat and a black hat and a muffler and all this sort of stuff. And can they see this person and all this sort of stuff? And the answer is, well, it depends. So they say, well, we need lighting that will show us that. That's actually very difficult there in black, because black absorbs light. It doesn't do anything else. So you've got to have something to contrast. So if your surface of the platform, for example, is concrete, you might be able to see that person. But if it's asphalt, at the same level of lighting, you might not. So just having one level of lighting doesn't actually crack your problem. So the code can't be the level of lighting. So then we started saying, well, perhaps we could define what you need to see. If you can define what you need to see, so let's suppose what you need to see is a person in black, 200 meters away, etc. That's what you need to see. You can convert that into something that can be a code, but your code is no longer lighting. Your code is the thing you need to see. And you need to produce the lighting that enables you to be able to see that, which means that in one station, you might need to have lighting of this sort, and in another station, you might need to have lighting of that sort. But in both stations, you can see the thing. So your purpose has now been satisfied. So your standard is the purpose. And that applies to other things. With another reason they had lighting was to be able to see objects, bombs and things like that, and so on and so on and so on. And you can do that. The same thing with train horns. They came and said, oh, train horns. We've got a problem with train horns because our new high-speed trains go so fast that our standard for a train horn is broken, because we require the train horn to be heard at so many decibels at such and such a distance. That's what the code says. And the train, if the train, the latest trains that came, they bought a whole load of trains, and these high-speed trains, and they bought these trains. And then they discovered that these trains had loudspeaker horns, electric. And the train goes faster than the loudspeaker can push the sound. So their answer for the train horn to be within their standard, they had to slow the train down. And I said to them, what do you want the horn? What do you want to happen when the train horn sounds? And it got them to think, well, actually, this is really about people working on the track. We want them to move. So what do you need this horn to do? That is what sets your standard. Mm-hmm. And then you tell the operator, they tell the train horn manufacturer or the train manufacturer, you need a horn that does that. If your train goes very fast, it still needs to do that. And probably it needs to be able to give you a certain length of time for the guy to get off the track or whatever it is. So you specify.
There's an outcome that's required.
And then you will find you need to test it with a moving train and all of those sorts of things. So when we're talking with engineers, we can still talk standards, but you might be talking standards in a different way. And I think that is the way that psychologist and engineer conversation can go, because the I might say I need the brain to be able to respond without releasing cortisol. I can't imagine a standard like this, but let's suppose that was what we decided was the key. So crowding. So we know that crowding releases cortisol under certain circumstances a lot, and therefore we might say you should not have a train that is so, I'm making this up, you should not have a train that is so crowded that people release cortisol. Hard to imagine this, how you do this, but let's suppose that that's what it was.
I'm liking the imaginary world there.
Yeah.
Keep going.
And I know roughly how crowded that train could get to. It would be something around, from what we've done, it'd be something around 2 people per square meter. Because that's when we notice that people are responding to the fact that there are other people. When it gets to about 2, then we see the response beginning. Beijing Metro operates at 8 mm-hmm. people per square meter. So way above that. London's about 6. Somewhere between 4.5 and 6.
We've seen those things in Tokyo trains where you have the men that are paid to push people
onto them. They don't do that very much now because it's too slow. But yes, that's right. They're up to about 9. And when you've got 9 people per square meter, everybody is in somebody else's, what we would call an intimate zone. So within about 40 centimeters of your face is what we would call an intimate zone. So people go into that zone because they are very friendly with you. So partner, friend, whatever, family, or as an act of aggression. So when you're at 8 or 9 people per square meter, everybody is in that space. So your body is reacting to that. So your body, the first thing's happening is your brain is saying, this is threatening. I need to flee. I can't flee because there are all these people there. So I'm in this. So now I have to work. My cognitive side has to start working really, really hard to suppress my panic, fear, that I'm, so I don't start flailing about and doing weird things. This is clearly a bad thing to do. And we see this in the cognitive performance of somebody who's been in that situation. It drops massively. So you go to work, you're going to be rubbish when you get there because the stress on the train has really killed you, your ability to do anything. And that cortisol will be rushing around your system for a few hours, just about stabilizing in time for you to get on the train to go home. And you do that for your working life.
And you're delighted when you get home. Your brain works properly then too.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you've got this kind of problem going on. So there's all of that going. So but that's what the brain's doing. So you might say, well, we don't want to create all that health problem. So what do we do? Well, obvious answer is don't have such crowded trains. How do you not have crowded trains? Well, you could have people opposite to the Tokyo thing. You could have people stopping people from getting on trains. Then you've got a big congestion problem in the station because everybody needs to get on a train. So why do they all need to get on the train? Well, they all need to get on the train because they're all coming home from work at the same time. Why are they all working at the same time? And we learned from COVID that it actually isn't necessary for, not, I mean, some people it is, but not for everybody. We come back to this question of the mobility. Why are we traveling? Why in London do we have 2.5 million people crossing the circle line, the yellow circle line in the map, every day between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. Why do we do that? Crazy. That's the whole system is built to accommodate that. It's massively expensive, massively unhealthy. If people could just walk down the road and do their job there, they don't even need to stay at home, but they might, or change their place of where they do their work every day and do all those sorts of things. You would reduce that. You would reduce
or tweak the hours or anything like that. Yeah, exactly.
And so you can move the working hours around, you can spread the peak and all those sorts of things. And I think what I'm seeing now, post-COVID, is that it's the employers are the kind of bad guys in the room, because they are increasingly, or some of them at least, are increasingly insisting on people coming into the office. Amazon's a good example. Insisting that people come into the office. Why? I haven't yet heard a good reason why they insist on that. And I think what results from that is that kind of peak hour, congested, stress-inducing, unhealthy process. And just trying to solve the crowding on its own, you won't. You've got to get at the bottom of that. And the bottom of that is, why do we think we need, comes back to the need and want and like, why do we think we need to do that? And I think the answer is we don't need to do it.
The magic I see of what you do is that because you've got that cross-functional expertise, I mean, musician, engineer, planner, psychologist, marketer in many cases, you're able to tell this story that then bridges that gap between those worlds. And you get the great pieces of innovation when you're able to reframe and challenge the assumption to then go, where we started, we might have been in conflict, but where we're actually trying to go to, we're trying to solve the same problem, but using different skills collaboratively. That's like a massively underrated thing, because too often it becomes I'm right, and we're having an argument versus like solving the problem. And I think like the environment that you built has done that really, really well. To me, that's a really, it, in some ways it sounds super, super obvious, but it's obviously not easy to do, otherwise everybody else would be doing it. I like to end these things on a little bit of a, if I gave you a magic wand, if you had this sort of like magic tool of, you can say, I really want to solve that problem, I really want that to happen, what would your magic wand be for what you're doing with the work with her?
I think my magic wand would be to be able to, what I want my magic wand to be able to do is to enable people to express their sociality in a social space, so that, in other words, we got some answers in a survey once. We asked people what would increase their well-being in the city that where they live, number of cities in the UK, and one of the strongest answers that came back is they didn't have a word for it, but they described a situation where they're walking down the street and they see somebody they don't know, and they feel that they can greet that person, they can say hello. And if they feel that they can do that, then that is what would increase their sense of well-being.
And I'm not very British.
Sorry?
Is that not very British?
Well, yeah, probably.
I come to, when I lived in London, there was almost like, even if you were with a friend on the tube, you didn't really speak to them.
Yeah.
And then when I moved to New York.
Actually, this is why the magic wand is really important. Because I think you do, yes, you're right. I mean, in the UK in particular, that may be a particular issue, but it isn't only in the UK. I mean, there's a city we did some work in Colombia, where it was way worse, because the homicide rate was so high that actually, if you did that, you could quite easily get shot, and that tended to stop people from doing that. And the mayor realized if he wanted to do anything with his city at all, he had to solve that problem,
uh-huh.
And I think he was very successful in doing that, right? But I think that's kind of the point. That's why you need the magic wand. We need to give people the confidence that is actually doable. It's actually our natural state, I think, but we cover it up, and for protection reasons. And we know it's a kind of natural state, because if you do it, one of the things that happens is you get a dopamine rush, slightly, or reward form. So if you say hello to the bus driver in the morning, you get a dopamine rush. And so does the bus driver. So both of you are now feeling happy. And it takes a little while. I did an experiment on that. I come to work very early in the morning just for whatever reason. I don't really, I get bored being asleep, so I come to work. Come into the lab and play the piano. So I thought, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to say good morning to the bus driver. So this is very early in the morning. It's probably the first bus or second bus out from the depot. And I get on the bus, I say good morning. And the first couple of weeks, obviously there'll be different bus drivers because then rotors and they're like having a heart attack. And then they started responding as I say good morning to them, and they go, oh, grunt, walk, you know, hello. And then it was about 3 weeks. One of them said good morning to me before I said good morning to them. Yes. Right. So why was that? I mean, this is a minuscule little example, but actually what was actually going on there is the dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. And they feel better. And because they feel better, they reproduce it. Now, if we could wave my magic wand so we got people to understand that, I think an awful lot of the problems that we now see, we talked about some of them, an awful lot of those problems kind of go away. I mean, you know, why do we only require infrastructure and vehicles to somehow or other provide a fully accessible interface? It's very hard to do that. Why do we need to do that? Well, we need to do it because actually we want to divorce people from this. Whereas actually, if we had that sociality drive, you can go quite a long way with the infrastructure, and you should certainly go as far as you possibly can with the hardware. But actually, the real accessibility is in your mind. And the magic wand that enables that feeling that I can help this person and that person is happy to be helped, and that connection happens because it's not about just helping, it's just being a socialized human being and to assist where necessary. I think that's, if we got ourselves to that situation, I think we would have a way better, more thriving, more sustainable, more accessible world. And I think, I suppose, in Pearl, I'm trying to find a way to do that. So my magic wand, do that.
I like how your magic wand is kind of what you're doing. That's so good. I'm very jealous.
I'm fine. And we have fun. I mean, the great thing is we have fun too.
And that, again, so important. Like, Nick, you're a joy to talk to. I've really enjoyed it. I could go on way longer. I've gone on longer than I normally do. Sorry. I really appreciate you spending the time. It's genuinely fascinating. And I know we got talking originally when I might have a thing that when I get a little bit more funding for, I want to come bring it to you guys. So I just really appreciate that you've been so generous with your time. And like, there's so many things that you've said in this. I didn't even bring a paper and pen when I went and sat down and changed the room for recording. I'm like, I'm really glad I get a transcript of this because there's so many good things. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much for the invitation. I look forward to hearing it.
That was great, eh? I loved that conversation with Nick. Could have gone on a lot longer. And I just want more of that thinking when it comes to creating better Challenger cities. Anyway, if you made it this far, I really, really hope that means you enjoyed the episode. Please do like, please do share. What I'm learning through doing more and more of these conversations is that we have this amazing opportunity to challenge and change our cities. And it's going to require so much more than just the municipal leaders themselves. So if you're a big company, if you're a small business, if you're an academic, if you're a consultant, we need to be doing more to help our cities become better places to live, to work, and to play. So here's to making cities challengers, and share this around. If there's people you think would get a kick out of listening to this, or if there's people that you think would get a lot of benefit by doing something together, that's what we're trying to do here. So stay tuned, more of these to come, and thank you once again for listening. Bye-bye.